Hey guys, welcome to the show. How's it going? Well, good. I'm so happy to pretend to hear what you said in response to my rhetorical question there.
Yeah, all right.
Hey, did you hear that? Something that wasn't The Onion played after the news and before the show. Something that was not The Onion. Isn't that great? I liked it. All right, good. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. Now, at least top of the hour, onionless, I believe, maybe.
I hope so.
Today on the show, Philip Weiss is going to be back. It's been way too long since I talked with him. You know, I should post on Twitter a selfie that I got with me and Philip Weiss from a year and a few months ago. Nah. Anyway, Philip Weiss is going to be on the show, and we are going to talk about Israel, Palestine, Iran, Congress, the lobby, the political parties, the candidates and the politicians, America's relationship with Israel. So, yeah, that's going to be great. Been way too long since I talked with him. And then also, there's this guy. I was talking about him on the show yesterday, Sean King. He's a writer for the Daily Coast, which, yes, that's the Democrats. Except, as far as I know, he doesn't write about electoral politics or anything. And even if he does, I don't care. Point is, he is a leader of some kind. I wouldn't place him because what the hell do I know? But he is a leader of the new black civil rights movement in America. And it's got quite a few charismatic leaders, and he's one of them. And, I don't know all about him, but I know that he writes a lot of great stuff. And I'm glad I follow him on Twitter. He's got a new one today called As Was Done With Mike Brown, Conservatives Feel the Need to Lie About the Life and Death of Freddie Gray. Isn't it interesting how much conservatives love government? I know, especially the liberals, they seem like, oh, they're small government types like the libertarians or something. But oh, no way, man. Communists got nothing on conservatives when it comes to love for the state. The only thing they hate about the state is anything that seems like they're trying to do something nice for somebody. But when it comes to the state's killing authority, oh man, they love the killing. And if you got a problem with the killing that the state's doing, they've got an argument for why it's all right. 100% of the time. That's what a conservative is. A communist on the right. Yeah. Anyway. Boy, do they love government. And if the cops murder some guy, cold-blooded murder, the kind that even a Republican would be prosecuted for if he wasn't a cop, and people got a problem with that, their first priority is to smear the guy. Yeah, well, he deserved to be dead, this guy who was murdered for making eye contact with a cop. Right? Just like in the scary emails that the conservatives send around. Don't ever look at a gang member in the eye or they'll kill you for that. Yeah, they meant the cops. Don't look at the cops in the eye if you're black, because that'll be a death sentence. I guess in 2015, we should all consider it, luck that they didn't just hang him from a tree, right? They broke his neck by other less celebratory means, but they still killed him. As Sean King writes here, to this very day, Fox News has refused to retract this story, and he links to it, this story in which they falsely claim that Mike Brown broke the orbital socket of Darren Wilson. Ha ha ha. Anyway, so yeah, man, I want to talk about some policing problems and maybe talk about the riots and talk about the future and talk about the problem. Oh, we got to debunk the conspiracy theory about the Bloods and the Crips and the Black Gorilla family are all merging together like Voltron to hunt down and murder all the cops. Poor little cops. Anyway, so that was a lie. Sean King debunked it. And anyway, yeah, that should be interesting. So, yeah, that's the show for today. Oh, man, I got to cough really bad. Hang on. Okay, I hope you didn't go away. I wasn't gone that long. I just had to cough. Yeah. You know what's funny? I saw this morning, apparently Hillary Clinton gave a little talk where she said, oh, yeah, you know, over mass incarceration is a real problem in America. Really? Like, we don't all know that's because of her and Bill. And the crime bill of 94, and then especially, or I don't know, both, I guess, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. Both of those, and even before then. In fact, Andrew Coburn's going to be on the show. We're going to talk about some of Bill Clinton's horrifying drug war policies. You know, he's as bad as George Bush Sr., Ronald Reagan, in every way. Hell, he made Barry McCaffrey the general that his drug czar. Remember that? Just look at the line graph there. And you'll say, wow, look at all the incarceration in the 1990s. So anyway, oh yeah, no, Hillary cares now. But better yet, and the real headline is, the people who want to believe in Hillary Clinton, this morning on Twitter at least, were so very impressed. Wow, Hillary Clinton cares about this. No, Hillary Clinton just said something about this, okay? You care about it. Stop projecting. Someone immediately tweeted me back and, you know, stars means like action going on. Licks finger, holds into wind. Hillary Clinton doesn't care about you. Give me a break. Who are these people who believe that Hillary Clinton cares about them? Cares about anything except for herself. She's just Rand Paul without the perm. That's all she is. Pure ambition. Personal ambition. That's it. Give me a break. Yeah, and speaking of Rand Paul, did you see he came out and said, well, you know, the reason for the riots in Baltimore is because Black people just don't take care of their kids. Yeah, Black men, they just don't raise their kids enough, and that's why there's a riot. Really? Lack of Black fathers, bromide there, huh? You sure it's not about the lawless, totalitarian police state that they live in, huh, Rand? And this is Rand, who understands and cares about Black people and their problems and likes to go around and give speeches to Black people saying, hey, I'm better on ending the drug war and reducing sentences and all these kinds of things than anybody on the left. So I'm why Black people ought to vote Republican. That's his whole thing. Oh, I'm so good for the Republican Party. I'm horrible on war. But I want to grow the Republican Party by inviting a lot of Black people into it, by addressing their problems like the horrible war on drugs and the lawless totalitarian police states that they live under in occupied east or west of whichever city you live in. And instead they ask him about Baltimore, and what does he say? Black men should be better fathers. Thanks, Rand, for your wisdom. I mean, your personal ambition. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. the entire process from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, we got some More at Home coming up with Sean King, and we got some Israel stuff to talk about with the great Philip Weiss. Tomorrow on the show, we'll have Andrew Coburn on the drone war. He's got a new one for Tom Dispatch. It's on Anti-War Today, right? Yeah. Good one for Tom Dispatch, which, man, I'm going to have to cram as much of his book as I can tonight. It's the only way to get me to read these books anymore, man. Give me a hard deadline. But today's Wednesday, man. I want to go skate. I don't know. Anyway, Andrew Coburn, he'll be on the show. And then also John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute. I'm finally going to cover this Jade Helm, et cetera, et cetera. Part of the reason I'm not too worked up about it is because they did all this in the 90s, and it was just practice for killing Iraqis, as bad as it was. It didn't have anything to do with enslaving all of us. That was almost 20 years ago now. So, you know, when they say urban warfare training, what they mean is real men go to Iran. And, you know, I don't know. It's all blowing back. Don't get me wrong. I ain't saying it ain't blowing back, but, yeah. All right. Anyway, so, yeah, War at Home stuff in a minute. Here's the war abroad, but where it affects Americans. Remember I told you Rand Paul went on Fox News and said, oh, yeah, nah, sometimes you gotta assassinate Americans with drones, I guess. Because, you know, I want to be president and I want to kill people too, so... Well, what did Ron Paul say? Exactly what I said he would say. I said, what do you think Ron Paul would say about this, using drones to kill Americans? Well, here it is in the Hill. Ron Paul, the good Paul, Obama, quote, literally assassinated, end quote, Americans in airstrikes. Now, what's funny about that, and they, what's cool is they show the video. They embed the video here of Ron Paul talking. But it's funny how to them this is all just self-evidently scandalous. Not the killing of Americans, but that Ron Paul would call it that. And this guy, Adam Gadon, you know, if you believe in the state at all, then I guess you'd have to accept that he was probably guilty of treason. But, you know, the Constitution explicitly forbids the government from killing Americans without due process of law. And hiding out in a safe house somewhere means that you have to hold down the definition of the word imminent and slit its throat in order to get away with pretending that that's an imminent threat. And, you know, personally, never mind state treason and all that, personally, I don't really care that Adam Gadon is dead. I'm glad that he's dead. He deserved to be killed. I don't care about that. But the government didn't have the authority to do the killing of him. You see how that works? It's sort of like, yeah, OJ did it, but the prosecutors didn't prove it. Because the prosecutors and the cops, why, they're even worse than him. So he still should have been acquitted, because the contest wasn't whether you think he did it or not. The contest was whether the government proved it or not. It's sort of like that guy, remember the guy who, I don't know, a year ago or so, he killed the mom, killed the little brother, kidnapped the 14-year-old girl. He was a friend of the family, the father's best friend. Killed the mom, killed the little brother, kidnapped the girl, pretended like he took her to Mexico, set down a false trail, but then he took off to, Utah, right? He was in the Badlands of Utah when he was spotted. And then what happened? They sent in the hostage rescue team equivalent. I'm not sure if it was exactly the FBI, HRT or not. It could have been somebody else now. I forget. But the equivalent of the Waco killers. And they went in, they hunted this guy down, and then they just killed him. As soon as they got sight of him, they just shot him and killed him. No put your hands up. No surrender. No, I thought he was reaching for his waistband. Which is ridiculous. But they just killed him. And they didn't have the authority to do that. Did he deserve to die, this guy? Yeah. We're all the jury here. It was beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was guilty. They recovered the little girl right there on the spot after they took his life. They saved hers. There's no question that he was guilty and deserved to die, or at least no longer had the right to live. But they didn't have the right to murder him. The only time it's okay for a good man with a gun to shoot a bad man with a gun is in immediate and proportionate defense of the self or another innocent life. Not, we know he's guilty and he would be executed someday anyway, so go ahead and put a bullet through him. At least, you know, that's the theory of the old USA that Ron Paul's referring to here. We live in the homeland now where the government can just murder whoever they feel like. A badge is a license to kill. You know, when I was as a kid, people used to talk about a license to kill as a fiction. That was how I first learned about it. Well, the government can't give a license to kill because government doesn't have a license to kill. They only have a license to kill in the defense, the immediate and proportionate defense of their own or someone else's innocent life, just like everyone else has. They just got the job being the security force. That doesn't give them any more rights or more authority to kill people than any other free, sovereign human being. What the hell is this? Kindergarten or something? But anyway, yeah, so Obama blew up some Americans to death with drones. Exploded them to death. And I'm not talking about the collateral damage, the hostage that they didn't know was there. I'm talking about Adam Gadon, the traitor. They killed him. Ahmed Farouk as well. And then Ron Paul says, hey, whoa, what's up with this, guys? What are we doing here? Just because government says they're guilty, then it's okay to murder them? No. And that's the scandal. Right? The Hill is not saying, look at what Ron Paul is saying, everyone. They're saying, ha-ha, look at what Ron Paul is saying, everyone. Wow, this is very dishy and maybe puts Rand Paul in a tough spot. How do you explain your father's opposition to presidential lawless assassination of American citizens, Rand? How do you explain that away? How scandalous of Ron Paul to say that there are words in the Fifth Amendment and that they are the law. That's crazy talk. Everybody knows that. First of all, Your Honor, just look at him. All right. Later on in the show, Islamic State news, Afghanistan news. But next up, Sean King and then Philip Weiss. So stay tuned. It's the Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org/chat to stop by there. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Well, dang, man, I don't have a number for Sean King. He never got back to me with the number. Nope. Well, I don't know. Maybe we'll interview him later on the show. Maybe we'll get him for 10 minutes in 10 minutes. Maybe we'll get him for half an hour in an hour. I don't know. But it's all right, man. I got plenty of bad news to cover anyway. Can you believe that? One thing, yeah, this may or may not fit in the interview, so I'll go ahead and mention it in the on the domestic police state front here, is this real long piece here from 2014 by the Baltimore Sun. It's called Undue Force by Mark Puente. And what Mark Puente describes is cops as out of control as any in the country, including beating the hell out of an 87-year-old grandmother and worse, all the time, killing people all the time. Undue Force. It's at the Baltimore Sun. Just search... police settlements, that's part of it. I like the way they put this, and you know me, I'm an abolitionist when it comes to government, so I'm against playgrounds and rec centers too. But I'm just saying, for comparison, the $5.7 million paid out in settlements of lawsuits since 2011 would cover the price... Oh, and that's not to halfway through 2015, halfway through 2014 when this was written, would cover the price of a state-of-the-art rec center or renovations at more than 30 playgrounds. And that doesn't count the $5.8 million spent by the city on legal fees to defend these claims brought against the police. Because, of course, the cops have sovereign immunity. They don't have to pay. They don't get their wages garnished for the rest of their life to pay off the settlement like any other person would if they got sued in this kind of way. Oh, here we go. Phone number? Oh, crap. Well, now he's got a real good excuse. A reason he can't do the show. That sucks. Okay, well. Isn't that too bad? Here, I thought I was going to interview this guy, but now it turns out I'm not. All right, well, that gets sent there. All right, well, anyway, so, well, crap, I guess I'll keep talking about this subject then, because there's a lot to cover here, and I feel like spouting off. So I read a thing, somebody sent me a thing by Christopher Cantwell. I actually don't know him that well, or I don't know him at all. I know his work, you know, kind of, sort of. And he's sort of the kind of crotchety, right-wing, gun-toting libertarian type. And says some pretty crotchety things sometimes, I think, is a way to put it. And this one says that, violence is necessary. That rioting is right. That, you know, F your breath is the slogan of the police state. They are at war against you. Poor black people especially. No doubt about it. Or I don't know if he says it like that. In fact, no, he says, you know, they're just as much at war with the rest of us in different ways. He says, you know, a white guy who pays $30,000 a year worth of taxes because he's afraid that they might come and start treating him like they do treat black people. If he doesn't, that guy's living in a police state too. All of us are. The state is our enemy. And, you know, I don't know if that's an exact direct comparison, but more or less, like, compared to the Declaration of Independence, the people of the United States, you know, if those are good enough reasons, not light and transient causes, but sufficient reasons to rebel against the English crown, then it could be argued. I don't think I agree with it, but I do understand. I'm not saying that Christopher Cantwell is wrong. I don't think he's necessarily wrong. In fact, I guess I'm saying I do think he's right. That at some point the line is crossed where the state is at war with all of us. And people have the right to defend themselves. Now, personally, you know, I'm much more on the immediate and proportionate self-defense thing. But then again, you know, I don't know. If the cops have come for 10 out of 20 families on your block, do you have to wait before they come to your house and not go and take part when they come for your next-door neighbor? There's a gray scale in there when it's this level of crisis. That's all I'm saying. That's what Christopher Cantwell's saying, something like that. I'm not trying to put words in the man's mouth, but, you know, here's what I think he's really leaving out, is that it's still a horrible strategy. Oh, well, one more word of credit to his argument, which is, for Christ's sake, stop attacking local businesses in your neighborhood and keep your eye on the target. Your enemy isn't racism, and your enemy isn't capitalism, and your enemy sure as hell is not the local drugstore. Your enemy is the state, the ones that are killing you. Now, I can see how someone who's poor and black and has no power would, you know, might argue that, you know what, the people who own CVS, they do have political power. I have none. But I don't see them saying, hey, lay off the poor black people. You know, they use their political power to lobby for more for themselves. That's all they care about, just like everybody else. But if anybody was going to be able to get the cops to lay off the poor black people, it would be the rich white people. So I'm not agreeing with, you know, the idea of collective guilt here or whatever, but I'm just saying I could see how poor black folks in the middle of a riot aren't doing too much differentiating. And again, most of the rioting is done by kids. You know, teenagers who basically are just, you know, realize that the cops ain't coming. We all have a field day today to get away with some stuff, so I'm going to go take some batteries and some Twinkies from the CVS. Not that much politics behind it. Most of the people who are real political about the murder of Freddie Gray were not the ones out rioting. I played you the clip yesterday, and we were going to talk with Sean King about this, about the Crips and the Bloods come together to try to stop the riot. Because they are keeping their eye on the ball. They want justice for Freddie Gray. And so it's just like I was trying to say yesterday. While I understand why some might want to riot, you know, how well they pick their targets to the side for the moment, I still don't think it's a good idea. That doesn't mean that everyone must do like Gandhi and, you know, just sit there and get hit in the head and maybe killed. You do have the right. People do have the right to defend themselves. But the problem is public relations. That's what it is. The problem is that rich white people basically see poor black people as an alien force inside their society and not part of it. And they're afraid of poor black violence to a great degree. So their bias already says that the cops are the good guys, the poor guys. And the burden, unfair as it is, the burden is still on the poor blacks to show that the cops are the violent ones and that they are the underdogs, they're the victims. And rioting or fighting back in a violent way, even if it's picking your target very carefully, is more harm than good to the cause. Even if they do have the right to resist, which I would never dispute.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff.
He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Me. Welcome back to the show. I'm Sky. It's my show. All right. Yeah, so the worst thing about the writing is it just changes the subject, man. It's terrible. You know, I follow a lot of right-wingers, left-wingers, libertarians, and everybody else on Twitter. I don't know where I've found all these crazy freaks. And the right-wingers, oh, they love this, man. The right-wingers, oh, yeah. Those poor blacks are so poor. They all have cell phones. And now they all stole a big screen TV and stole a bunch of beer. And so now they can sit around and watch the game on their big screen TV and drink their beer. And in other words, oh, what hypocrites, all poor blacks in Baltimore who are complaining about being murdered by the cops, having their friends and family members murdered by the cops are. Oh, what criminals they all are. And even better, just never even mind them. Never even mind what happened to Freddie. Never even mind what happened to the 10 guys they killed in the last year in Baltimore. Let's talk about CVS Pharmacy some more. They love it. And why? Because conservatives love government. Way more than any commie you've ever met. They love government. They love it. And they get so mad when you point out that government is just a bunch of gangsters with a bunch of hitmen who run around committing crimes against people, extorting people. Conservatives only complain when the extortion money gets spent on a little bit of kickback to keep the poor from rioting. Stop bribing them to keep them from rioting. That money is to go to bullets only, insist the conservatives. Oh, and lavish pensions for cops. $80,000 a year starting salaries. And retirement in their early 50s. Conservatives love government. Oh, they love government. And versus a bunch of poor black people, my God, they love government 100 times more. When it's going up against a bunch of poor black people. Break one window and any claim that you had to the right to your life in the face of a lawless police state, in their eyes, discredited completely. That's all it takes. And of course, the reason the riot started has been reported in multiple places now. There was an article about it yesterday and, I played a clip of some Bloods describing the situation. I saw another thing this morning. Oh, I forgot what it was. Anyway, I've seen this a few different places now that the protests have been going on for days. Nobody cared. Nobody paid any attention to them. So they took it down to the Orioles ball game where a bunch of drunken sports fans started mocking them and calling them the N-word and other like insults. And saying, we don't care about your stupid protest, about your stupid dead friend. We don't care about you. Which then that led to the fist fights, which led to the riot. So I'm not saying that people rioting aren't responsible for what they're doing. Everybody's an individual on all sides of this thing. But you don't see Wolf Blitzer emphasizing that. Yeah, it all started with when some drunken wannabe pig got himself into a fist fight with these peaceful protesters. Oh, that was one other thing I wanted to say about Christopher Cantwell's article that somebody tweeted to me this morning that I read that I totally agreed with, which is the hashtag Black Lives Matter. He said something about it that I hadn't thought of, but that I totally agree with. My complaint has been that the hashtag should be independent prosecutors or something, right? Something, some kind of actual reform, not, hey, DAs, stop being racist, or some amorphous non-demand. It needs to be, we want all 50 states to pass laws that the DA from another county gets to investigate every cop crime. Something. That's my bright idea, best I got, other than abolishing the state entirely. Let the market take care of it. What the hell is this, Russia? But anyway, as long as we do have these state monopolies on force, we need something like that. Somebody with less of a conflict of interest to prosecute these cases, right? Something? And Cantwell is right when he says it's not just blacks, it's everybody who are the enemies of this state. No, and that goes for you, too. No matter how much you love the government, they still consider you the enemy. Just like when Snowden leaked secrets to journalists so they could tell it to you, the government called that treason because they consider you the enemy. But anyway, his point was that I hadn't thought of that I agreed with so much was that, and I hate to think this is true, but I do think it is probably true, that the slogan, the hashtag and the slogan Black Lives Matter, even subconsciously, is telling everyone else this isn't your problem. And of course, you know, if you're a black person and you're living through this, then it's pretty easy to see through those eyes why it sure seems like a black thing to you. Because, of course, black people are the easiest people for government to get away with killing because there's that much less of a chance that they'll have any political power or say-so, ability to fight back, ability to hire a good lawyer or to have their family hire a good lawyer or, you know, have a relationship to a powerful person. Oops, you accidentally killed the state assemblyman's son or that kind of thing, you know, less a chance of that. And better chances with the DA and with the grand jury and with the judges if it ever came to that. But the point is, when the question is, what's to be done about it, by focusing on the race aspect, they're basically what? Demanding that all people in the white majority change their hearts to be less racist than before, and then start insisting on less racist government policies someday? End anti-black racism. I mean, that's noble and that's great, but it's kind of such a big point that it misses the major point, which is, how do you make cops fear that they might have to go to prison for the rest of their lives if they murder somebody? Because right now they don't fear that. Right now you know that no matter how mad you get, no matter how willing to forget libertarian principle you are in your anger, something bad might happen back to you if you go and kill somebody. Cops don't ever have to consider that. Ever, 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 ever. They know that they can get away with killing people. They know that there's no accountability. So how do we change that? By making America less racist someday? Or by figuring out ways to bring in for outside accountability? And that should not mean, and it wouldn't mean, it couldn't mean, the national government. I mean, I guess it's possible to imagine some crazy new agency or whatever, but basically the Justice Department already has civil rights investigations and that kind of thing. But that's a whole different standard than just a homicide charge. That they have to show that they did it in a way that was provably racist or provably premeditated, provably a deliberate decision to violate the rights of someone, not just a bad call in the process of committing police work, where violence is part and parcel of the entire thing. Right? So in other words, they have to be yelling, "Take that, you N-word," while they crack the guy's skull in with the butt of their gun. Something like that. Something extra blatant. But again, a badge is not a license to kill, and the same standards for homicide exist officially in the law in all 50 states for cops as regular people. They don't have an official license to kill. They just have a de facto one. They have one in practice because the cops and the judges and the attorneys and the rest of them are all in on it together, and the legislatures too. The only thing that can change that is hardcore outside pressure. I think at least it'd be a step. Outside prosecutors from other counties within the same states should get all these cases, right? No? I don't know. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Huh. All right. Well, I guess so. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live here from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. And sorry that Sean had to cancel, but we'll see if we can get him on later in the week. But we still got Philip Weiss from the Mondo Weiss blog, where he writes a lot of great stuff, and so does half a dozen other great writers, too, mostly on the subject of America's relationship with Israel and related issues along those lines, which there are many. But anyway, so welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
Great, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing real good. Very happy to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So there's a lot to talk about. And so I guess the best way I can conceive of it is we got the biggest issues, of course, still are the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the nuclear deal, and then American electoral politics and all the posturing and all the money and all that that entails and what all that has to do with it. And it's funny because I'm looking at the makeup of the lineup here, and I almost would prefer a third Obama term at this point, because at least he hates Benjamin Netanyahu, right? Where everybody else is in a contest to see who can please him the best.
That's funny. Yeah, they are. You get no endorsement for Hillary Clinton from me, but at least she's been supportive of the Iran deal, and of course on the other side, I think Rand Paul, while he's made some missteps on the Iran deal, I think he in the end will support it. So, but other than that, you know, they're taking vows to overrule the Iran deal or undermine it.
Well, you know, you had a article here from about Haim Saban saying, you know, don't worry about Hillary, she's with us on this Iran thing.
Right.
Never mind what she says about it. But I wonder what that really means, because if she's telling him, hey, it's politics, I have to support Obama, I'm his last Secretary of State, I have to support him on this, there's no way I can not do it. But so what's the end of that sentence? She promises to ruin the damn thing when and if she wins?
I don't know. I mean, I think that...
Because he sure sounded satisfied with her answer,
yeah.
You know?
You know, on the one hand, I think it's completely fair to be conspiratorial about this whole business because there's, you know, secret conversations going on all the time. And today we learned that, you know, the reason that Jeb Bush has been sounding so hawkish is that he was trying to get Sheldon Adelson's money. And, you know, he needed to throw Jim Baker under the bus to try to get Sheldon Adelson's money, and he won't get Sheldon Adelson's money. So that's that happens. On the Hillary side, I just don't know. I don't know where – I think that there actually is some movement on the Democratic side in the Israel lobby, the Democratic Israel lobby. I think there is some movement to support the Iran deal. So you have J Street – vigorously supporting the Iran deal. That's great. I just don't know that Chaim Saban, he's a real conservative on these questions. I don't know where he's going to end up on it. He made those comments, and yet Hillary and, you know, Bill Clinton, too, has stood up for the Iran deal. So I have my hopes that there will be a political center forming in American life that, you know, supports the deal. So I'm ever hopeful.
Yeah, well, you know, I have to say, I mean, it seems like Obama and Kerry are pretty much committed here. And in fact, I'd even go so far as to say it seems like they already have the deal. And it's just politics. They have to take their time in getting the last little details lined up and all that. So once they had the deal, I mean, it seems like, well, did you think that the Corker thing in the Senate, that was actually a victory for Obama on this? Because at first it looked like, oh no, the Republicans got their veto power. But, then I saw where Bill Kristol and over at Breitbart actually, what's his name, had a write up there about how, oh no, the Republicans blew it. And they basically, you know, they could have done all these things to make sure that they had the power to scotch the deal. Instead, now they have to wait until the deal is signed and all the political, you know, wind is going the president's way. And then they only have a very narrow amount of time to try to overrule it, et cetera, like that.
You know, I've read what you've read. I think that certainly the neoconservatives are very unhappy with this Corker-Cardin bill. It's not going to derail the deal. And so, but there are signs that even AIPAC is now supporting it because they're saying, okay, let's just fold in now. This is where we got a big majority. Let's fold in. It's scrutiny after the deal is cut, as you pointed out. It only gives Congress a window later on the sanctions. But I think that what we're going to see is, because it doesn't do that much to stop the deal, I think we're going to see other efforts to stop the deal. So I think it seems like it was a bit of a draw. Mm-hmm. That Obama hopped in on it, rather than treating it as adversarial, he hopped in on it and got changes that made him comfortable with it, and that defanged Congress somewhat with respect to the deal. But I think the result will be that AIPAC, the neocons, they'll be back in action in other ways to try to stop the deal.
Meaning like adding poison pill amendments to it and that kind of thing?
Well, I don't know. Apparently, AIPAC says we don't want poison pill amendments. I think that there might be other efforts to just, you'll see other efforts to derail this thing. I mean, they're not going to sit. I don't, you know, that's June, right? I mean, we've got 2 months before the ink dries on this, or, you know, before the terms are laid out. And I don't think they're going to sit quietly between now and late June. I just don't see it. I see other efforts, either if not of a legislative character, then, you know, this kind of renegade diplomacy that we've been seeing again and again. Hmm.
Well, I mean, I think the worst example of that would have been using Jandala to murder Iranian military officers back in October of 2009 during the talks on the first nuclear swap deal, which killed that. But you think they might go that far? Or what do you have in mind?
Well, I mean, I would never put some things past them. I mean, if, for instance, Let's say that there was a flare-up on the Lebanon border between Hezbollah and Israel. Let's say, you know, that could do a lot to suddenly create problems for the Iran deal. You'd have Hezbollah being gaining a lot of support from Iran. You'd have a quote-unquote, you know, war. I mean, they think there's a Netanyahu speaks of an unending war with these folks, but you know, that's one thing that Israel might end up doing. Who knows? I just don't think that, given the rhetoric, I don't think that this is going to end with a whimper. It's gonna there's going to be some banging going on.
Yeah, I wonder how much that has to do with the whole narrative of the Houthis in Yemen being backed by Iran. And look here, we and our allies are in a shooting match, a direct shooting war or a proxy shooting war with Iran right at the time that we're doing this deal.
Yeah, yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, obviously, I mean, there's a Saudi angle here too, although I think the Saudis have gone along with the deal by and large, you know?
Yeah, they seem to have. Although, I don't know, I read at least a few public statements they made along those lines, but I guess I don't know, you know, the real diplomacy there. It seemed like they're kind of joining their policy at the hip with the Israelis right now on, certainly on Syria, huh?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, so,
right.
But I'm just observing, that's the kind of thing I just observe from a distance. I can't offer any sort of insight into that.
Yeah. All right, well, so we got a lot to cover after this break, which is coming up in just a sec, but this news just came in from Haaretz. Rand Paul tells Jewish leaders, I do not support war with Iran over their nuclear program. His audience at a Brooklyn Hebrew Day School today.
Wow.
And he also said it was wrong to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
That's great. You know, some
like
guys,
nicely,
you know.
All right, well, hang tight, everybody. We'll be right back with Philip Weiss in just a minute. MondoWeiss.net is his great website. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking Israel and politics and the Iran deal and things with the great Philip Weiss from MondoWeiss.net. He's got a great stable of writers over there, too. I hope it's in your bookmarks and you'll look at it all the time. Here's a very interesting article I didn't get to read about Dorothy Thompson. Definitely getting back to that.
Yeah, it was good. You know about her, huh?
I've read one thing about her before, probably by Justin Raimondo, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm.
But, yeah, so listen, I wanted to get back to what you said about George Bush there. Jeb Bush, same difference. Jeb, he took James Baker by the skull and threw him right under the bus there about as far as he possibly could, and I think repeatedly.
Yeah.
And yet, I think you said, oh, no, he's at least in the Adelson primary. He's already lost and he will not get Sheldon Adelson support. Is that right?
Well, I think that, you know, Adelson is a mercurial figure. He's an old guy who, you know, acts on impulse. And right now, though, according to this report that's come out from in National Review, Adelson is epithet removed, rip epithet removed about Bush's closeness to Jeb Baker. He said it's going to cost you a lot of money if Baker goes before J Street, the liberal Israel lobby, and says anything critical of Israel. Well, Baker went ahead and did it. Bush couldn't stop him, and now Adelson's saying you don't get the money. I think if Bush is the nominee, the Republican nominee, that Adelson will get behind him, just as he got behind Romney the last time.
Sure. Yeah, it's funny to me, because I guess I just assume that all of the major constituencies in America, and they have nothing to do with region or ethnicity or religion really at all, mostly, all the major constituencies are the banks, the insurance companies, the arms dealers, agribusiness, and you know, obviously Israel and maybe the AARP and the NRA a little bit. But other than that, The AARP and the NRA are probably the only actual popular pluralistic organizations that have any real influence whatsoever when it comes down to it, that could barely qualify as one of those power factions. And Jeb has all those locked up. It seems like Adelson would know to go ahead and get behind a winner here. Who are they going to nominate? Marco Rubio? I mean, give me a break. It's obviously going to be Jeb Bush.
You think that Bush has a clear path to nomination?
Yeah, just because of connections. He walks in there with all of the fundraising avenues and all of the meetings already lined up. He's got such an advantage.
And they want a winner, right?
People, you know what he is? He's John Kerry from 2004. He's John McCain from 2008. He's the last choice, and he's the shoe-in to win because everybody else has a fatal flaw, you know? He's the guy that's left standing at the end kind of thing.
Well, but he's the center.
McCain's actually the best analogy because he's the liberal Republican swing voter type.
But Scott, we've got a while to go before this happens, right? I mean, there's always surprises, right? That's what I always think of.
Sure. No, I mean, I guess I'm just saying all things being equal. Obviously, Jeb could get caught saying the N-word in front of an open microphone or something, and that'd be the end of him.
But. So, what about Hillary? What's her path like?
Well, I think she's pretty much guaranteed the nomination, but I think Jeb will win the general. Because her negatives are just too
high. I heard it here first.
Yeah. I don't know why this isn't obvious to everyone, but maybe I'm just wrong.
Someone sent me a note the other day saying it's Scott Walker, man. That guy's a comer, you know?
Well, you know, he is referred to as also top tier with Jeb. I admit, I don't know enough about the guy, really. Maybe he could be the Romney to Jeb's McCain, kind of the second tier guy. But all the rest of the guys, Rand and all the rest of them, are second tier unless, you know, there's a massive earthquake and everything shifts, you know.
Well, how do you feel about Rand's navigations and twists and turns on the Iran business?
Well, I never did like the man. Mm-hmm. I think like Hillary Clinton, he cares about himself first and everything else a distant second or worse. And I don't trust his integrity, and I don't trust, he reminds me a lot of Barack Obama and his supporters, a lot of the Obama bots from 07 and 08 who just want to believe, despite all evidence, that there's a secret Obama in there, that once he has total power, then he's going to get really liberal then he's going to get really libertarian or whatever. But I just don't believe that, you know.
Do you give Obama any props for the fact that he is got this poisonous relationship with Netanyahu?
Yes, that's the thing I like about him best, is the Iran nuclear deal and just the fact that he and Netanyahu don't get along, which I entirely blame on Netanyahu. I mean, Barack Obama is no idiot. He had every reason in the world to get along with Netanyahu, and I think tried hard to. But,
yes.
But, you know, and I know it sounds kind of pat or whatever, but I think that Netanyahu is a white supremacist racist, and he thinks that Obama basically is fit to shine his shoes, and he can't imagine that he's got to talk up to this guy and treat him with respect, and he just never could get used to doing so and never did. And so Obama's attitude has got to be like, well, who's the emperor and who's the lackey here? Come on.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, I'm sure that a lot of American black politicians would agree with your analysis. And God knows that they expressed a little of that recently during when Netanyahu came to Congress. The media don't talk about that angle. They'll talk about the American right and how racist they are against Obama, you know, all the time. But, you know, and impute that motive. But I think there's some truth to that. I mean, blacks are second class citizens in Israel. Anyone who's not Jewish is a second-class citizen.
Yeah, well, and even among Jews, the whiter you are, the better, too, right? As far as the law goes and power?
Yeah. I don't know about the law. I mean, certainly the Mizrahi Jews, the Jews from Arab countries, have traditionally had a second-class, have been a lower status in Israeli society. That is beginning to change, and you're seeing the old Ashkenazi elite, which is smaller and smaller, it's blurring a little. It's less of an important distinction. And Netanyahu's coalition is so much involves so many Mizrahi Jews, and a lot of the leaders are also Mizrahim. So,
Yeah. Hey, I wonder if there's any chance that you're not in a hurry and could hang around and do one more segment with us today, Phil.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, cool, man.
Sounds great.
I guess so. On the other side of this break, y'all, which I started a little bit early here on the outro, what I mostly want to ask you about, I think, in the next segment will be the future of the Israel-Palestine relationship. And also, you know, as it has to do with American politics and the American government's position on the issue, election year and otherwise. But
okay,
it
so during
really
the break,
important when Netanyahu announced that, there will never be a second state. And when he tried to backpedal, didn't seem like anybody believed the backpedal. They believed that he was finally being honest for once for election's sake.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great moment. Yeah, fabulous. Yeah.
But so there's a real big question of what comes next then, obviously. So
I think you're right. It's important.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what we'll get to on the other side of this break with Philip Weiss from the Mondo Weiss blog. I'm sorry, you trying to say one more thing there? Go ahead.
No, I had nothing to say, man.
Oh, okay. So yeah, Philip Weiss, MondoWeiss.net. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and I talked Philip Weiss into staying one more segment with us on the show. He's at MondoWeiss.net. And Israel-Palestine, that's the thing. Netanyahu just won re-election, and he won it by getting out the vote with a bunch of scaremongering at the last minute. All states are based on fear, of course. What might happen if I wasn't here? They sell us. But the thing was, he let the truth slip out, that there never will be a Palestinian state. And, you know, we had, Phil, didn't we, the footage back from 2001 that was leaked, where he's in a home, I think a settler's home, explaining how he screwed Bill Clinton and finagled his way out of the negotiations of giving up any part of the West Bank and was laughing about it, right? America's easily moved.
Said,
don't worry about them.
Yeah, United States is something that can be easily moved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. It was a great moment. I mean, he promised that there will never be a Palestinian state, and then he rallied his voters to the polls on election day by saying that Arabs are coming out in droves. So both these statements are things that the Obama administration condemned, rightly, but also it's a great revelation. I mean, if you've been over there, you know that it's one state. It's all under one country's control. There's 22% of the territory is Palestinian territories, but they're just, you know, it's tyranny. It's Israeli tyranny and Israeli army everywhere. And so now Americans get a chance to see this for themselves. And the media have tried to avoid this subject, but it's right on the table now. There is not going to be a two-state solution.
All right, so now, and I guess that was obviously has been the case from a lot of points of view for a long time, and then I think a lot more people came around to that point of view at the end of Kerry's attempted negotiations in, I forget, I guess 2013 was when they finally gave up on that, right?
Right. It was a year ago. I think 2 years ago he said, "Give me 2 years." You know, so we're right where the 2 year thing was supposed to end. So
all right, but now that Netanyahu has said this, and nobody's buying his walk back of it, it's sort of like the "let's all pretend they don't have nukes" thing. Now it's over. Now it's let's not pretend they're ever going to give up the West Bank and all of that, because they're just not going to. So, but what does that mean for American politics? Just, oh, well, status quo forever? Or because they needed that pretension of so-called peace process this whole time for some reason, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I think it's another thing that's going to drive a wedge between the Republicans and the Democrats. Now, And that is actually a hopeful sign. I mean, because Republicans don't care. They're going to say, hey, we're for Israel on any terms. And Democrats are going to say, oh, we were for the two-state solution. And so you're going to see that the chance exists that a year from now, we are going to see an active conversation inside the Democratic primary process about where's the two-state solution that you're for, and shouldn't we just be supporting democracy? Is it just too wild an idea to support equality of all human beings in Israel and Palestine? So that conversation, I think, is going to happen inside the Democratic Party. And the Republicans are going to help it along by saying the Democrats are anti-Israel. And then you're going to see some kind of glasnost inside the American political process over this question, I believe, because people will actually get to take different stances. Now, the Democratic Party is going to continue to line up with the Israel lobby, even the left side of the Israel lobby, J Street, but I think that you're going to start seeing the Democratic base echo Palestinian human rights and one-state arguments.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess importantly, being that they're liberal Democrats and even the leftish side of the liberal Democrats, they should be at least somewhat inoculated from accusations of anti-Semitism, because after all, they're civil rights liberal types. They're not.
Yeah.
It's not like if the conversation was in the Republican Party, then it's that much easier, like they try to do with Ron Paul, just say, oh, he's just an anti-Semite. You don't have to listen to him, which, of course,
exactly,
is the furthest thing from the truth.
Yeah, which neocons, you know, they actually, you know, they locked up the Republican Party in just that way, and they threw out Jim Baker. They thought they had thrown out Jim Baker a long time ago, along with, George H.W. Bush. But, hey, look at Jimmy Carter. He's a persona non grata in the Democratic Party. So it can happen in the Democratic Party, too, and watch. They're going to try. So.
Yeah, and it wasn't because he's kind of a laughing stock as a president because he never got us into any real major wars. And so it's not that. It's that he wrote a book about Israel saying, hey, man, you're destroying yourself and you're destroying a bunch of innocent people.
Yeah, and it's apartheid. Guess what? It's apartheid. So, which, you know, now just about every – that's another great thing is that that's being – that word is no longer verboten inside the left-wing – part of the mainstream discourse. People can begin to talk about apartheid. I think you're going to see more and more descriptions of Israel and Palestine as an apartheid situation.
Mm. But now, I mean, you know, when we were talking earlier about Hillary Clinton having the nomination locked up, and as you said, the Democratic Party is still going to toe the Israel lobby line on all this stuff. So it still raises the question of what anybody can do about it, even if they're a major faction inside one of the major two parties.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's been the case. I mean, you know, you talked about Dorothy Thompson, okay? Yesterday, and she's the journalist whom Obama saluted at the end of his White House Correspondents Association dinner the other night as someone who stood up for her ideals. Well, and she lost her career to Zionists at the end of her career. And yesterday, I saw was a film that she promoted back in 1949 about the Nakba. The Nakba was the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians from their land. And what you see when you see this video is you understand these facts were known. Everything was known. The suffering of the Palestinians was known. The occupation when it began was known, just not known in America. So when we talk about Palestinian suffering and human rights violations, they've been on. They never end. They never end. The only question is when that knowledge is going to begin to break into the American discourse. And so, no, I agree with you. They've still got it locked up politically, but I think we're going to begin to see some growing understanding. And part of it is the end of the Holocaust as a giant theme in American discourse. Younger people who haven't grown up with the Holocaust as a shadowing their experience, and who've grown up with multicultural experience and diversity, and you know, you're supposed to tolerate fellow human beings.
Yeah. All right. So, how much power and influence does the boycott movement have on this so far? You think they're doing pretty well?
It's hard to say. I mean, well, they're doing great because they're terrifying Israel. They're upsetting Israel supporters, and they're raising the awareness, and people are talking about BDS. They have had several signal victories, chiefly in Northern Europe, but they've also helped with divestment campaigns at various American institutions, liberal institutions. So I think they're vital. I mean, I just think it's a little bit like the South Africa situation, and that it's just who knows what ends these things. It's a combination of factors, but this one is absolutely vital, and it may be symbolic largely so far. But man, it is racking up some. It's driving the conversation.
Right. Yeah. It's just like electoral politics or any kind of activism on that level, just bringing awareness by being active and getting the work done, having a conversation about it. You have people who will never really have any part of the actual movement or be able to make a decision or participate in any kind of decision to divest anything. But this is where they first hear about the issue that, wow, there's something that people are really mad and fighting about. I wonder what it is, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. I hadn't thought about that, but I think that's the discursive power, yeah.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, thanks for coming back on the show, man. I always learn a lot when I talk to you, Philip.
Oh, Scott. Feelings mutual, man.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. That's the great Philip Weiss at MondoWeiss.net. Oops. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. That was funny, man. What a great clip. Free Talk Live. I like those guys. Not just because they give me a radio station to be on. All right. So, yeah. This is just funny. It doesn't really matter. It kind of matters. I don't know, man. The Mujahideen e Khalq, their leader, Maryam Rajavi, is going to testify before Congress. And then get this, Ali Gharib over at The Nation got a transcript of her talk, her prepared talk. Really? What a good source he had. Ali Gharib, but I'm pretty sure he's not a liar, man. He does good stuff. I like that guy. And then, so, the point is that this speech is about how the way to defeat the Islamic State is regime change in Iran and making her the president of Iran. Yeah. Well, what's funny about that, of course, is that Iran is the only real force in the Middle East other than the United States that's fighting the Islamic State. The Turks apparently love them. The Turks have an army that could go in there and kick their ass. Our NATO allies for 70 years or whatever now. But they love the Mujahideen. They don't give a damn. And apparently America doesn't give much of a damn that the Turks don't give a damn. So they're not going to go in there. They're, you know, my other headline over here is the Turks outright helping, and the Saudis too, helping the Islamic State take Idlib province in Syria. Who's the only government helping the so-called Iraqi government, the government of Arab Shiistan, George W. Bushistan, from Baghdad down to Kuwait there? Who in the world is helping them fight the Islamic State? Only Iran. They go, ooh, everyone hiss and boo because it's Qasem Soleimani. Ooh, wait, and why do we not like him? Because he's the leader of Iran's Quds Force. Ooh, that's pretty bad. Okay, and then, so what is it that he's doing? He's helping the Shiite militias and the 5,000-man strong Iraqi army fight the Islamic State for us. Well, wait a minute. Don't they owe us the favor after America fought a 10-year war for them? So, why aren't we cheering that, look, our enemy, for some reason we can't figure out, the Iranians, are fighting and dying in place of American guys? Not that I think America ought to be backing them up with air power, because American power tends to distort the power of the locals on the ground and just lead to further consequences like the ones we're dealing with right now. So, anyway, the leader of the Mujahideen-e cult, communist terrorist cult, they're an Iranian communist cult of weirdo Mujahideen guys. And get that, they're Marxist holy warriors. How the hell do you figure that? Anyway, they're the communist Mujahideen, the people's Mujahideen, who killed Americans back when Iran was a fascist dictatorship backed by the United States in the 70s. Killed Americans in terrorist attacks and that kind of thing there. Then helped with the revolution that overthrew the Shah and his regime. And then targeted the Ayatollah and that new regime and got kicked out of Iran, where then they went to work for Saddam Hussein. And when George H.W. Bush encouraged the Kurds and the Shiites to rise up and overthrow Saddam at the end of the first Gulf War and then left them high and dry in a giant Bay of Pigs type of sacrifice sort of thing and did nothing to help them, it was the MEK who helped lead the war against the Kurds, working for Saddam as his special forces unit, basically. And then they worked for Saddam, lo, those many years of Bill Clinton's blockade war against Iraq. And then when Bush Jr. invaded in 2003, America inherited the MEK, and so did the Israelis. And they've been using them to spy and assassinate inside Iran ever since. Oh, and also funnel bogus Iran nuclear stories through the Sunday Times. And they're a gigantic joke to everyone who knows them. And, you know, I've interviewed this kid, Jeremiah Gulka. I shouldn't call him a kid. I interviewed this man, Jeremiah Gulka, from the Rand Corporation, who went and did a study over there of the MEK. And he talked about how, oh, yeah, no, these grown men and women have to raise their hand for permission to speak. They're forbidden from having sex. Their kids are all taken away from them, far away from them, and basically held as hostages. That you better stay in line at all times or you might never see him again. And I don't know if the husband is even alive. I mean, nobody says outright, I don't think, that obviously he's dead, but he seems pretty damn dead. I don't know if anybody knows where his body is. But this is like Bow and T, the Heaven's Gate cult that dressed everybody up in black pajamas and purple Nikes and had them drink the Kool-Aid and die back in the year 99 or whatever it was. Remember? Was that 2000? I was going to say the year 2000. The year 99. Something like that. Remember that? The cult in L.A.? We all have to die so we can hitch a ride on the comet. We're talking that level of cult stupidity and control, really. Mind control over these people. And, you know, they oftentimes will pay bums to dress up in yellow to go and stand at their protest and that kind of stuff. I don't know where they get all that money, guys, to pay all these bums. But anyway, so yeah, now, and of course, the theme of her speech is to be just like Netanyahu says. You know, the problem here, just like Rand Paul says, the problem is radical Islam. Really? We're in the middle of a massive sectarian war between Sunni and Shia. Not that they're fighting over you have the wrong religion as much as they're just fighting over who's who and who's in whose group and who's on the other side and that kind of thing. Although ISIS pretends to be pretty damned pious in their way, I guess, as do the Iranian and Iraqi Ayatollahs. But anyway, we're in the middle of a massive sectarian war between Sunni and Shia, and here we got the conventional wisdom, the common narrative in America is, oh, radical Islam. You don't need to parse a thing. You don't even need to figure out, you know, who's on Iran's side and who's on Saudi's side. Whose sides are they on? Nah, you know what? That's all way too complicated. Just forget it. Radical Islam is the enemy. And so how do you defeat ISIS according to the communist terrorist cult, the MEK? Well, you got to defeat their main enemy, the Shiite government of Iran. Because, you know, radical Islam. Got to get rid of that radical Islam. Got to start somewhere. Why not start with ISIS's worst enemies? Because then that somehow will lead to the end of ISIS. Can't make this stuff up, dude. All right, so I guess that's my Iran nuclear deal coverage for today. Oh, other than this, Netanyahu told Cabinet, our biggest fear is that Iran will honor the nuclear deal. You got to read this thing in Haaretz, man. It'll blow your mind. I bet you can find it reprinted other places, too. It's such a big deal. Netanyahu told Cabinet, our biggest fear is that Iran will honor nuclear deal. And then there's like six different quotes in here about, no, really, they won't cheat. Not we won't be able to catch them cheating, but they won't cheat. The best spin, the meanest, scariest spin the Israeli prime minister has left is that 15 years from now, you will have been lulled to sleep and will no longer take the Iranian threat seriously, at which point then they're going to sneak up on you and make a bomb. Okay, guys. All right, so now what time is it? Oh, man, the show's almost over. It'd be nice if I had one more segment so I could tell you about Israel reportedly hits Hezbollah and Assad targets in Syria. That's right. The Israelis are flying American jets, really F-16s, that America gave to Israel, are flying literally as Al-Qaeda's Air Force in Syria. Flying for the Al-Nusra Front in the Islamic State against Hezbollah and the Damascus government there. Isn't it funny how that's not even a scandal or anything? Well, you know, radical Islam, guys. Radical Islam. Yep. All right. See you tomorrow. Thanks, y'all, for listening.